Turning back this morning to the passage in the Word of God we have read from already, and that's the book of Judges, the 8th chapter there. The book of Judges, the chapter 8, and we'll turn again and read verse 4. For those who have been regularly here, you'll know that we are on a series at the moment on the life of Gideon, a brief series, and we're coming to message number 6 out of 7 in total in that series. Verse 4 of Judges chapter 8. And Gideon came to Jordan, and passed over, he and the 300 men that were with him, faint, yet pursuing them. We're looking at verses 1 through to 21 today. Be careful where you plan to go on holiday. You might just end up on dangerous ground. According to an article in the magazine Pulse, there are 56 nations in the world that have serious problems with landmines. Angola, for example, has 20 million mines waiting to maim or kill. Afghanistan, where quite a number of our troops are still, has 10 million mines. Cambodia, 4.5 million. And the expense of removing all of these mines has proven to be more than those nations can afford. The wars that almost destroyed each of those countries may well be over, but the dangers have not yet vanished. A famous Scottish Presbyterian preacher in a former century, Dr. Andrew Bonner, said, and he wasn't thinking of landmines when he said it, but what he said is good counsel for us, "Let us be as watchful after the victory as before the battle." Now that advice, "let us be as watchful after the victory as before the battle," was needed by Gideon after he had routed the Midianites. What a night this had been. And chapter 7 of the book records what happened in the battle against Midian. What a night it was in the history of warfare in general, when this mighty host of 135,000 fully armed soldiers had found themselves decimated and devastated and defeated by a handful of 300 men. Men that were only armed with ram's horns, clay pitchers, lights, and strong pairs of lungs. Scan the volumes of historical records of conflict and warfare in the past, and you'll not find a match for this scene, not a single one. Not at the Alamo in 1836, when 180 Texans and U.S. citizens held an old mission fort at the Alamo for 11 days until they were overwhelmed by a large force of Mexican troops. And while a lot of literature has been written and films made extolling those men's heroics at the Alamo, it doesn't disguise the fact it was a defeat. Not in the Battle of Britain in 1940, when then British air power was outnumbered virtually 5-1, and Churchill rose and made his victory speech, including the memorable words, "Never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few. In none of those and similar kind of conflicts was there anything that came to be the equal of Gideon's victory." What a night for the nation of Israel in particular. This miraculous night of victory would be long remembered, just as we today remember our courageous dead during the course of two world wars. So the Israelites, they were going to celebrate this triumph. And I can imagine it, hear it being said of Gideon's 300 at those future Jewish celebrations of this victory, "They shall not grow old as we who were left grew old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn at the going down of the sun. And in the morning we will remember them." And they did remember these valiant men in many years to come. However, in the middle of the high trumpet notes of victory came the dull, sickening thud of some landmines going off. I'm referring to a number of attacks of disunity that occurred immediately after the victory. Judges chapter 8, verses 1 to 3, tell us about one of these attacks of disunity. It came from the men of Ephraim, And as we read on in the chapter, Judges 8, verse 4 through to 21, that details the other event, when people of the cities of Succoth and Penuel, they became the source of a second internal dispute. Now, arising out of these disputes after the battle, and the taxes they are from within, come a number of points for us to note, and the first one is this. The man who was doing the will of God, as Gideon was, shall be opposed. The man who was doing the will of God shall be opposed. Gideon had already destroyed 120,000 of that Midianite army. Judges 8 verse 10 tells us of that. He's now hot on the trail of the remaining 15,000 who had been able to run off and escape the general chaos and carnage around the spring of Harod. This remaining 15,000 was governed by two Midianite kings, Zeba and Zalmunna. And Gideon, as he comes along, he thinks, if only I could catch those two men. Because he knew that if he captured and killed those two kings, then the power of the enemy would be so crippled, they would not be a threat to Israel for many, many years to come. They had been up here into the land for 7 or 8 consecutive years, but he knew, if only I can get Zeba and Zalmunna and wipe out their troops, we will not suffer from these men for many, many years in the future. He would secure the safety of his borders. And more importantly, he would fulfill his commission that he had received from the Lord. But first of all, Gideon had to contend with the mine of self-promotion. The mine of self-promotion. The men of Ephraim, it becomes clear in verse 1, they came and they stirred up a fuss about being left out in the original battle. They weren't content now to being called up to do the mopping up operations. They wanted to be in the real thing. Judges 8 in the verse 1. And the men of Ephraim said unto him, why hast thou served us thus, that thou callest us not, when thou wentest to fight with the Midianites, and they did chide with them sharply? At this time in the history of Israel, Ephraim was a large and important tribe. In fact, it was second only to Judah. The tabernacle was located in the territory of Ephraim, in Shiloh. A great leader of Israel, no less a figure than Joshua himself, had been a distinguished member of their tribe. Joshua had come out of Ephraim. So here were men that felt, we can flex our muscles, we have influence. We should have been called here. We have an impact in this land. Why are you ignoring us? Now the real problem is, of course, that they were suffering from a disease that is very much in evidence today. It's the disease of pride. And so they march up to Gideon with their complaint. Why didn't you call us to fight against Midian? Why did you leave us out? And on the surface of things, it sounds like a valid objection. Until we consider that Ephraim had made no effort to stir itself, rise up, and attack Midian on its own. Although they would have known of Gideon's attempt to raise an army for the purpose, and knew that Gideon was sending out messengers through the country, rallying the troops. 32,000 did come initially, but not one man of Ephraim mobilized himself or marched down the valley to present himself a volunteer in Gideon's force. So they had no reason to moan. Their complaint now was motivated virtually 100% by personal jealousy, by injured pride, and by most probably a sense of loss. They may have taken fear here that they were going to lose out on some of the valuable spoils of the battle that had been fought against Midian that day. And they knew that those who hadn't participated in the fight didn't get a share of the loot. And that bothered them. Usually when people criticize something that you've done in the cause of Jesus Christ, there's a personal reason behind the criticism. Maybe they wanted to do it, and you got doing it instead. Or maybe you'll never discover what the personal reason is. Gideon had won an astonishing victory. All Israel, including Ephraim, were going to benefit greatly from that victory. bumper harvest next year all around the country. No invasion from the Midianites next year. No molestation from foreign forces. Now this was tremendous. All the country should have been full of joy, but Ephraim showed no joy at all at what the Lord had done through Gideon. Ephraim showed no enthusiasm about this wonderful victory the Lord had given his people. No gladness, no thanksgiving before him, nothing, only bitterness of heart. To put it in a nutshell, Ephraim was totally selfish. They placed such a priority on their own affairs that they now wanted Gideon to stop the battle until their little need was satisfied and their little problem and objection was addressed. It's a sad affair. As soon as God began to bless his people, this is what's happening here. As soon as he began to bless, they were blighted by an attack of disunity in the midst. It was tragic that it happened, and it's tragic that it still occurs today. At times of greatest triumph for the people of God, the greatest danger often comes from within. Some people feel left out. Not that the church is to blame or other believers are to blame, because those same people were given the same opportunity to become involved in the battle as everybody else. Ample space was given to them to enlist in some avenue of service, but they did not, by their own choice, come forward. These people who have been left out, or more correctly, who have absented themselves, then become jealous at those who threw their wheat into the battle and win the victory. And then comes the murmuring and the complaining and the backstabbing and the pathetic, contemptible sniping at comrades. I think of what happened in the book of Acts. When the devil had been going around feverishly and mustering every attack that he possibly could from outside against the Church of Christ, he had tried ostracization. He had tried persecution. He had tried imprisonment and failed. What did he do? He tried to destroy the unity of the believers by a series of attacks from within. He raises up Ananias and Sapphira, members of that church, to throw the body of believers into chaos. Acts chapter 5. And when that didn't work, he whipped up a strife between the Greek-speaking and the Hebrew-speaking Christians over the way in which widows were being looked after. That's in Acts chapter 6. He was attacking from within. You know what a modern equivalent might be? Why is he up there doing that and not me? Or why did he make the committee at the election and I didn't? Or why did she get such recognition for the harvest decorations and not me? Why them? Not us. When people are trusting Christ for salvation, backsliders are being stirred up and restored, and established Christians are growing and developing, Satan will pull out all the stops to provoke dissension and promote disunity. Anything will do. Pride, hurt feelings, difference in calling and gifts, personality differences, variations over minor doctrines, no matter what, as long as it's something. There's nothing more than Satan loves than to see the saints at each other's throats. And this is his chief method of arranging it. Get an attack going from within. Get the spectators roused up, not merely to spectate, but to snipe. He loves to see us divided at loggerheads the one with the other, and we should be doing everything in our power not to give him the opportunity. If only we had the spiritual sensitivity to understand what he is at, we would push all this material back from where it comes, down the throat of the devil. Satan can get us so worked up that we actually believe fellow believers are our enemies. So when these men of Ephraim should have been thanking Gideon, praising God for delivering the nation, they're criticizing him, and they're adding to his burdens. Now it would have been very easy for Gideon to have flown into a blind fury with these Ephraimites, to have scalded them with his wrath. He could have put them in their place with a few choice words, knowing that now he was a victorious general, a national hero, the people's choice for king. Gideon could have pushed his weight and used his influence and put Ephraim back in its box. After all, it's so easy to sit back and criticise after the crucial victory has been gained. So easy to be brave after the battle has been fought. So easy to talk big and do little. So easy to take up the position of a spectator who was good at nothing else but pointing out the faults and the shortcomings and the mistakes of others. Gideon could have banged heads, but what did he do? He showed that he was not only able to control an army, but also his temper and his tongue. And he went for the Proverbs 15:1 approach. A soft answer turneth away wrath, but grievous words stir up anger. And so in Judges 8:2-3 we read, "And he said unto them, What have I done now in comparison of you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer?" That's his own home area, where Gideon was from. "God hath delivered," verse 3, he says, "into your hands the princes of Midian, Oreb, and Zeb. And what was I able to do in comparison of you?" Then their anger was abated toward him when he had said that. A soft answer. A word of congratulation for the minor role in which they had played in the mopping up operation. That soft answer turned away their wrath. Gideon followed the path endorsed by Proverbs 16:32. "He that is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he that ruleth his spirit than he that taketh a city." In Poor Richard's Almanac, 1734, Benjamin Franklin wrote, "Take this remark from Richard, Poor, and Liam. Whate'er's begun in anger ends in shame." Now, from Gideon's response to the abuse that he shipped from the Ephraimites, we can learn some vital lessons. One is, the unity of God's people is more important than personal pride. The unity of God's people is more important than personal pride. Nobody likes being wronged. Nobody likes being criticized unjustly. But are we willing to take our hurt to the Lord and let Him deal with it in His time rather than opt for some needless punch-up that will deal damaging blows to the entire body of Christ? Another lesson, we must never take our eyes off the enemy. We must never take our eyes off the enemy. Gideon didn't have time to mess about here with Ephraim and start disputing and hold a council and work it all out. Their little complaint that had no grounds whatsoever, he couldn't take the time over that one. He had still the Midianites to deal with. God had called him not to fight internal battles at this moment, but to contend against the external foe. And he must not be deflected from God's call in his life. This was the problem with Ephraim. They had obviously so much time on their hands to discuss their own feelings and grievances because they had no burden to do the Lord's work. They had no appreciation of what the Lord required of them. They had never bothered to sit down and seek His will for their lives. And is it any wonder then they are so clearly out of step with God's servant Gideon? It's often the case that those people who have bags of time to criticize the lives of other saints are people who have no desire, no urgency, no enthusiasm, no intention of doing God's will for their own lives. Let us learn to do as Gideon did. Leave the trouble with Ephraim behind and press on after Midian. Get our commission from God. See what He wants us to do, and don't rest or allow ourselves to be wrapped up in the frivolities of this life until that commission that we have got is fulfilled. However, no sooner had Gideon dealt with this first landmine than he stepped on another one. If the first was that of self-promotion, the next one was that of self-preservation. Self-preservation. In Judges 8, the verse 4, down to the verse 21, we're told about this other, second attack from within. And it's a much more bitter one. Gideon is still pursuing the remaining two Midianite kings, Zeba and Zalmunna, and he's doing it as quickly as he can. He reaches two Israelite cities. Succoth is the first one. Penuel is the second one. They are cities in the territory of the tribe of Gad, about 50 miles from the battlefield. You'll read about them in Joshua 13:27. Now by this stage, Gideon's soldiers are exhausted. The same 300 are with him, and they're in need of refreshment. And when he comes to Succoth and comes to Penuel, he asks some provisions, please, for my men to keep us going. Judges 8, verses 4 and 5. Looks for a little hospitality to be shown. Uncommon hospitality is one of the basic laws of the East. He looks here for brethren to help brethren. Gideon's men, the men of Succoth, the men of Penuel, were men of Israel together. Gideon appeals, we have a common relationship. Surely a common battle, and definitely a common foe. Help us out. He's not looking for anything excessive. Just loaves for Gideon's little force. And that was very well within the means of these men of Succoth and the men of Penuel. Consider that Gideon's army had done a massive favor for the men of Succoth and Penuel. Succoth, Penuel, they had not contributed any manpower or equipment towards the right of the Midianites. Gideon's men, on the other hand, had laid down their lives on the line, taken the greatest possible risks, fought the key battle so that Succoth and Penuel and all the cities like them might enjoy freedom from Midianite oppression. It's like soldiers going off to war, through the First World War, maybe through the Second World War, coming back and finding, as many did, there are no jobs and nobody wants you. They have done their bit. They have laid their lives on the line. They have been prepared to go for the ultimate sacrifice. But when they come back, there's not a lot of gratitude shown. Unbelievably here, the men of Succoth and Penuel turned Gideon down flat. Judges 8, verses 6 and 8, and the princes of Succoth said, are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna now in thine hand, that we should give bread unto thine army? Verse 8, and he went up thence to Penuel, and spake unto them likewise, and the men of Penuel answered him, as the men of Succoth had answered him. So the two cities are of one mind, we're not helping you, Gideon. They looked at Gideon's army, they saw people who were hungry and tired and poorly equipped, and they reached the conclusion this ragtag outfit has no chance of defeating the 15,000 strong force that still exists of the enemy under Zeba and Zalmunna. And so they argue, you fellows will never do it, call it off, don't be pursuing them any further, catch yourselves on, and if we help you and you fail, then these two kings of the Midianites are going to do a U-turn, come right back, they will muster another force of men, they will march into our land again, we will be among the first to be attacked, rounded up, massacred, because we helped Gideon. No, they said, we can't afford to be seen giving you so much as a loaf of bread. We can't afford to be seen in support of your cause. We must stay sweet with the enemy. They were in the business of saving their own skins. Now this was not entirely out of character for them. The tribe of Gad, where these two cities are located, Succoth and Penuel, the tribe of Gad, had not sent soldiers on a previous occasion when Israel was at war in the days of Deborah and Barak in Judges 5 and the verse 17. And now men from the same tribe, the tribe of Gad, are still locked in the same mood. They refuse help to Gideon. While some are risking their lives for the cause of the Lord, they are content to be doing nothing and doing nothing in such a way that they actually are thwarting the attempts of God's faithful people to defeat the enemies of Israel. Now their actions show the most base ingratitude for all that Gideon had done for them. Their actions show a total disdain for God's work. We are not interested in that. We are only interested in coming down behind the winner in the conflict, whoever he might be. Their actions in refusing to give Gideon's little band some sustenance that's vital to them in winning the war, their actions mean that they actively oppose the cause of God in the land and they shift the advantage into the hands of the enemy. Bad practice. Criminal act. It amounted to treachery. As you go out to battle for Christ Jesus, learn this cardinal fact. There will be discouragements. We will be discouraged by the power of our enemies. We will be discouraged by the weakness of our friends. We will be discouraged by the smallness of our past efforts. But by far the most damaging are those who come from the traitors within. During the Normandy invasion 1944, all sorts of devious traitors were working for the Nazis. Fifth column men, they called them. Marshal Pétain of the Vichy government, that French government that was collaborating with the Nazis, he declared on the 7th of June 1944, France is becoming a battlefield. Frenchmen, do not pile up misfortune by acts which will bring about terrible reprisals. The representatives of the Vichy government told those French people, don't give the American soldiers anything. Lord Haw-Haw's voice, William Joyce the traitor, was still sounding out, and as usual cutting across some British wavelength. And these fifth column men still exist. The men of Succoth and Penuel have their modern equivalents. We will encounter detractors and discouragers aplenty. If the devil can get you dragged from out of the number of Gideon's band and cause you to look at them as a bunch of enthusiasts and fanatics and over-the-top fundamentalists and all the rest of it, see how everybody despises them, see how everybody out there ridicules them, you wouldn't want to be seen dead amongst that lot. And if he can get us dragged away from Gideon's band into the ranks of Succoth or into the city of Penuel, then the devil will be happy. You will be one less body for him to contend against. A weakened saint, a wandering child of God, useless in the service of Jesus, a traitor to your master. I can't emphasize it enough. Don't hang back and refuse to involve yourself in the work of God. Or if you are so determined that you were going to stand aside from God's commission and close your ears to his will for your life and do nothing for him and not respond favorably to his command, if you're going to do that, at least don't discourage those who do want to move forward with God. I often wish I could make a few metal signs, paint them with luminous colors, put a chain on them, and go up to some carping, criticizing Christian and adorn him with it. Hang it round his neck. Do not discourage others. There will be detractors and discouragers. There is our own deceitful heart. Satan looks for assistance from within and in the form of our flesh, our carnal nature. He has that assistance ready-made. The fifth column, the infiltrator, the collaborator, the devil's pal in her bosom, the enemy within. This nauseous Nazi sympathizer is already in place. We need ruthlessness in dealing with sin in our lives and with the hordes of Satan too. I find it interesting that just after D-Day, General Eisenhower broadcast a message, had it printed on leaflets as well, thousands of which they dropped over France. Destroy, it said, the Nazi tyranny, root and branch, so that the peoples of Europe may have a new birth of freedom. He warned the French people of further deprivation, and to the collaborators he said, those who have made common cause with the enemy will be removed. This is the way to deal with it. Watch him, starve him, strike him. Do your utmost to remove him. Do what Paul said he did, 1 Corinthians 9:27. But I keep under my body, or I pummel that flesh of mine and bring it into subjection. Lest that by any means, when I have preached unto others, I myself should be a castaway. Do what he counsels should be done in Colossians 3, 5 and 8. Mortify therefore your members which are upon the earth. But now ye also put off all these. The man who is doing the will of God shall be opposed. But then, and I will move quickly in these points, God's man must not allow any opposition to obscure the will of God. God's man must not allow any opposition to obscure the will of God. Gideon didn't waste time trying to force the arms of the men of Succoth and Penuel up their backs, trying to make them do what they didn't want to do. He also warned them in Judges 8, 7 and 9 that he would be back after his victory to execute punishment upon them. So he says, okay, you refuse to get involved in the fight for the freedom of your people. Fine, men, let's get up and away. We will not be kept back by anyone from doing the will of our God. Gideon had experienced the Lord beside him. He was conscious he had a mission to accomplish in his name and for his glory. It was a case now of him, we will not, we cannot, we must not call a halt. Opposition can come. Landmines can go off. But he had such a clear sight of God's commission in his life. He was determined, we'll not let any of this opposition divert or deflect us off course. We will go on to victory. God give this kind of spirit to all of us who were involved in serving him, that we will say, the cross before me, the world behind me, though none should join me, still I will follow, no turning back. I'm glad that Gideon pressed forward. Delights my heart to see him here, envisage him coming out with dust on his face and tiredness affecting every muscle, with ridicule being thrown in his face by those who should have been on his side, and yet still he goes forward. Nothing can deflect him. Nothing can stop him from doing the one thing that God has told him to do. He reminds me of Paul here, as he put it in Philippians 3, 12 to 14, this one thing I do, forgetting those things which are behind, I reach and press toward the mark for the prize of the high calling of God. There will be no turning back from our ultimate goal. I have a target. God set the target. I must reach it. There's a tremendous lesson to be gleaned from Gideon's single-mindedness here. D.L. Moody once said, "Give me a man who says, this one thing I do, and not these 50 things I dabble with." Benjamin has really declared, the secret of success is constancy of purpose. And surely Judges 8 and verse 4 is a wonderful commentary on that constancy. And Gideon, we're told in verse 4, came to Jordan and passed over, and he and the 300 men that were with him, faint, yet pursuing. Like the drop, but still pushing on. Still following the terms of God's commission. I wonder, do we know this kind of constancy in fulfilling the will of God? The hymn writer said, "Let us not grow weary. In the work of love, send the light. Let us gather jewels for the crown above. Send the light." That's why we're here. That's our obligation and duty and responsibility under God. I think of Paul again, and Paul said in 2 Corinthians 4, verses 8 and 9, that he was troubled on every side, yet not distressed. Perplexed, but not in despair. Persecuted, but not forsaken. Cast down, but not destroyed. For he still staggered to his feet again, no matter what was thrown at him. And he said in 2 Corinthians 4 and 16, "We faint not. But though our outward man perish, yet the inward man is renewed day by day." And couldn't Paul then write in Galatians 6 and verse 9, "And let us not be weary in well-doing, for in due season we shall reap, if we faint not." Despite the difficulties, despite the discouragements, we have an obligation to go forward, faint, yet pursuing. This is the key thing. Keep going until every enemy is subdued, Satan is bruised under our feet, the kingdom of grace and glory is extended, and the person and work of Jesus Christ is exalted in many a sinner's heart. The man who is doing the will of God shall be opposed. God's man must not allow any opposition to obscure the will of God. Thirdly and finally, the man who is doing God's will has a duty to overcome all opposition to it. The man who is doing God's will has a duty to overcome all opposition to it. Gideon had some unfinished business here. Part of his unfinished business was with the external or the outside enemy. 15,000 Midianites still on the loose. Still a threat to his country. Still would be liable to come back should they not be subdued. Judges 8, verses 18 to 21 makes it clear that on a previous occasion, the Midianites had taken a group of unarmed Israelites by surprise. And in fear of their lives, this little group of Israelites had retreated up the side of a mountain, Mount Tabor, but they couldn't escape. The Midianites captured them and slaughtered them, apparently for no other reason than for the amusement of the leaders of Midian, who were Zebah and Zalmunna. It was like the Nazi SS herding Jews and gypsies into a truck, driving them to a ravine, lining them up, and cold-bloodedly pumping machine gun fire into them. This was the Old Testament equivalent of that. And here were two of the leaders of Midian who had been present, in charge of that grisly event. Zebah and Zalmunna, in verse 18 of Judges 8, they boasted to Gideon that the men they had killed on that occasion, each one resembled the children of a king. Some of them, it turned out, were Gideon's own brothers. Now Moses in the law had instructed Israelites to redress wrongs, particularly the murder of one of their people. In Numbers 35, 9 to 34, in Deuteronomy 19, 1 to 13, we have the details. The next of kin was to assume the role of the avenger of blood, and Gideon now assumes that role. Had his brothers been killed in the heat of a battle, it would have been different. He would not have exacted revenge on their killers. But because the Midianites had been guilty of cold-blooded, wanton slaughter, Gideon slays them. I want you to notice that Gideon carried out his divine calling completely. He had been given the task of defeating Midian. He didn't pause when 15,000 men broke off of the 135,000. He didn't pause and let them go. He went after them until he had an utter victory. He's to be commended for having done in such a thorough fashion what he had been sent out to do. And we have a responsibility to fulfill before God. There was a matter then with the external enemy, but also the matter with the internal enemy, the treacherous men of Succoth and Penuel. And on the route back to Jordan, Gideon's victorious force drops in at Penuel and Succoth again. The two cities that hadn't given them a loaf of bread between them. They remind the elders of their refusal to help, and they execute the punishment they promised upon them. Chapter 8, verses 6 to 9. Their big crime in these two cities had been treachery against their brethren and rebellion against the Lord and against His work. And God does not deal kindly with those people who bear His name, I am a Christian, but who obstruct His work. He cripples their power. He shrivels their influence. Often, He removes them, takes them out of the way. During the revival of 1858-1859, Dudley A. Ting was the leader of a remarkable gospel mission in Philadelphia. The Sunday before he died was outstanding, in that at least 1,000 persons were converted to Christ. A few days later, he's watching a mule at work threshing corn on an old machine. He stepped forward, patted the animal on the neck, but the sleeve of his coat became entangled in the machinery. His arm was torn off. From his deathbed, he sent a message to the meeting being held in the YMCA in Philadelphia. The message was this: tell them to stand up for Jesus. George Duffield, who preached the funeral sermon, wrote these words: stand up. Stand up for Jesus. The trumpet call, obey. Forth to the mighty conflict. In this His glorious day, ye that are men, now serve Him against unnumbered foes. Let courage rise with danger and strength to strength. Oppose. Today is a day of wilting and withering Christians, of spineless and stomachless Christians, of cowering and cowardly Christians. We don't want to bear the name of Jesus. We don't want to be seen on His side. We don't want to fight for Him getting the gospel out to those whom the devil has held captive at His will. And they're clutching after every wind-blown straw of excuse why they should not stand up and contend for God and His truth. Stand fast. Hold the ground. No retreat. And do not, under any circumstances, be guilty of opposing the work from the inside. That's a command of God to us.